Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Michael Harpaz lives in Israel. He's a musician, an actor, and MC. His life has been defined by travel and crowds. Like here in 2015, when Michael led thousands of people in a chant at the Birthright Israel mega event.
Here we go! Am Yisrael Chai! Am Yisrael Chai! Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael Chai!
That used to be a pretty normal day at work for Michael.
I spend my life on stages, traveling around the world, performing in front of hundreds of thousands of people all the time.
The pandemic changed all of that. Strict lockdowns became the norm in Israel. But Michael was able to work safely from studios. However, for weeks at a time, his four kids weren't even allowed to play in Tel Aviv's parks. And the live entertainment industry?
Brought to its knees. Literally brought to its knees and then decapitated.
But as of last month, Michael and currently more than half of Israeli adults got his COVID vaccination. He knows it. And many local venues know that about him, too. So does the Israeli government. How? Michael has a new app on his smartphone. It's a vaccination passport called Ramzor, or traffic light in Hebrew.
Has my name in Hebrew and in English, has my passport number, my ID number, my birth date. Tarikh. I forgot that. Okay, so there's an expiration date on the vaccination certificate as well, which I just noticed.
Israelis who've been vaccinated or have recovered from the virus qualify for the app. It's got a green box and text showing when a person who's been vaccinated received the second dose. It also indicates when the vaccination passport expires, which for now in Israel is 6 months after that second dose. But there's more. People are calling it a passport for a reason. Michael's digital vaccination document has a QR code on it, one that businesses like restaurants, movie theaters, they can scan it when he wants to go in, places where, for now, only people who are vaccinated can enter. This is from a public service announcement about the vaccine passports from the Israeli Ministry of Health. The ad shows blue doors with green check marks swinging open to scenes of people enjoying meals in restaurants, servers still in masks, people working out at gyms, folks catching a movie, a live stage performance. All as a way of touting the vaccine passport as part of the path to some kind of return to normalcy. Now, this is not the first time the Israeli health authorities have used smartphone tech during the pandemic. They used it for contact tracing. Michael has received government-issued text messages alerting him that he was physically near someone who tested positive for coronavirus.
The reason I got that message is because they're tracking my phone. They know where I am. They know where I, you know, civil liberties or not. Nobody cares about the porn that somebody may be watching, or the, no one cares about the weird purchases that you're making. They want to know if you were if you were somewhere else next to somebody else who's, if there's a way to make you not spread the disease.
But the government knowing where he is, that doesn't really bother Michael.
It's an emergency situation. So they did what they needed to do. You know what I'm saying?
Israel's vaccine passports were first launched in late February. The range of places they give access to was expanded beyond gyms and theaters to a wide range of attractions, including restaurants and cafes, just this weekend. So Michael Harpaz, he has a live, in-real-life gig scheduled for later this month. But when we talked to him last week, this is what he was most looking forward to.
I'm going to take my wife to go have a bite to eat somewhere, just to sit in some place that's not my kitchen and have some food that was cooked by someone other than myself or my wife.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Now, Michael may be sanguine about his new vaccine passport, but some Israelis are not. The app has had significant problems since its launch, according to Haaretz. Israeli cybersecurity experts discovered problems with the app's reliability when it comes to vaccination verification, and they say the tech can be leaky with private information. Moreover, the vaccination passport is meant to allow vaccinated Israelis or those who have recovered from COVID into certain venues. That means it can also be used to keep others out. And in mid-February, only a third of ultra-Orthodox Jews had been vaccinated. Not even a quarter of Arab Israelis had had access to a first dose. So what do the new vaccination passports mean for those groups? Today, we're going to talk more broadly about vaccination passports because the Israeli example gives us a clear indication of the possibilities and pitfalls of the tool. It's worth thinking through right now because the EU is considering vaccine passports. So is the UK. And here in the United States, President Biden's coronavirus strategy asks government agencies to look into the possibility of having digital vaccination certificates here. So a powerful tool to protect public health, or a powerful tool to expand the surveillance state? Can those two be balanced? Hop on social media, by the way, Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. Would love to hear your thoughts about this as the hour goes on. Well, we're joined today by Nida Farahani. She is a law and philosophy professor at Duke University and the director of the Duke Initiative for Science and Society. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Ruth Faden, founder of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Ruth Faden, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So I'd love to start, first of all, just keep focused on the Israeli example here for the first part of this conversation. And Professor Faden, let me just turn to you. What is it that having a vaccine passport program within Israel's borders allows the country to do that it otherwise couldn't?
It's not entirely clear, actually. The intent is to be able to open up the economy and also open up people's lives with less public health risk. So that's the objective. We get small businesses, large businesses recovering more quickly, more safely from the standpoint of the pandemic by limiting access to public venues to people who have some proven immunity, at least for the short term. The other objective, of course, relatedly, is that people be able to enjoy their lives more than they have previously in the way in which your guest Michael was describing. Being able to have a bite to eat with a partner in a restaurant is no small thing.
Right.
But whether to what extent the passports will actually achieve those objectives is something we need to interrogate.
Need to interrogate now or wait to see sort of how
both?
Okay.
Yeah, I would say both, Meghna. I would say both. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm all for interrogating it right now. But let me also ask you. So we should note, and I said this at the top of the show, but it's an important distinction that Israel has, that on average, overall, they're at the 50% vaccination point. Is that one of the things that's allowing them to move forward with the using something like a vaccine passport to help sort of lay out the path to, you know, quote unquote, some kind of normalcy here?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. But I would say absolutely for a number of reasons. You need arguably a significant proportion of the population vaccinated to have this have the kind of impact on social and an economic life that you wanted to have. So there's that. I mean, if there's just a small fraction of your population coverage, it's not going to make a meaningful difference. So now we're at, a little, not quite 10% of the U.S. population. We're way behind in Israel. But I'm sure we're going to get to the equity conversation pretty quickly. From an equity point of view, it's not only the percentage of the population overall that's vaccinated that makes some difference, but it's also the proportion of the population groups that are vaccinated. And that's critically important. I'm sure we'll turn to the equity question shortly.
Well, let's get to it right now, right? Because that's one of the major underlying concerns here, as, you know, the entire world is considering vaccine passports. So, Professor Farahani, what are your sort of primary concerns or observations with the Israeli program?
So I have a few concerns, and I would say it's a little bit different depending on where you are as well. I'll start with one thing that we touched on, which is the efficacy of it, before turning to the issues of equity and trust that I think it creates. So, you know, the question is, what is the goal of the passport? If the goal of the passport is to try to keep others safe, right now, what we know about the vaccines is that they help the individuals who have been vaccinated with one, if it's the J&J, or two doses of the vaccine, to have a much less likely occurrence of severe disease, potentially even symptomatic disease. What we don't know yet, although we hope is the case, is that people who are vaccinated don't transmit the virus to other people. And based on the way that the vaccines work, it seems likely that people nevertheless get some infection that they're able to stave off quite effectively. And what that could mean is that you're still able to transmit it to other people. So if the point of a vaccine passport is to create a space where everybody is safe, you know, if everybody who is there is vaccinated, then presumably every individual who is present is less likely to themselves get severe disease. Mm. But if you do it asymmetrically, that is, as some places are contemplating, like all employees of a restaurant, for example, are vaccinated, but not necessarily all of the patrons are, that doesn't necessarily keep the patrons themselves safe from transmission of SARS-CoV-2.
Well, we've got to take a quick break here. I'm sorry to jump in on you there, but we've got to take a quick break. We'll definitely dive as deeply as we can into all of these issues regarding vaccine passports when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about the concept of vaccine passports. Israel already has them that allows people who've been vaccinated against COVID-19 access to restaurants and bars now. The EU is considering them. Maybe the United States, too. And we're getting a lot of response on social media from listeners about this. For example, someone calling themselves Asa Esquire says, yes,
It would encourage vaccination and stimulate a return to normalcy while reviving the service economy. Someone else who calls himself For Lord's Sake says, no, let's just focus on getting people vaccinated. It would change nothing if those vaccinated can still be carriers. And Patricia McMahon says, as long as vaccines are available equally to all, I would accept the idea. But if minorities are shortchanged, it could be something like voter suppression. I'm joined today by Nita Farahani. She's a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. Ruth Faden also joins us. She's a professor of bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. And Professors Farahani and Faden, I just wonder if you'll listen along with me, because I want to refocus this conversation on the United States and the particular sort of health, ethics, and civil liberties concerns around the potential for vaccine passports. And in fact, New York State just rolled out a pilot program for a vaccine passport called the Excelsior Pass. It's been used to get into basketball games at Madison Square Garden and at also sporting events at the Barclays Center. The pass is a result of a partnership between the state and IBM. Now, we reached out to New York State officials for comment. They did not reply. But here's more information. The Excelsior Pass is a digital pass. It confirms that either someone is vaccinated or has had a recent negative COVID test. So we spoke with Albert Fox Kahn, the executive director of the New York-based Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, a nonprofit that opposes government mass surveillance. And Kahn says he sees many potential problems with the Excelsior Pass, beginning with the possibility of disparate impact.
By having this vaccine passport system, we're going to take the communities that have been so systematically underserved during this pandemic and punish them further, cutting them off from public life. And to me, this is absolutely maddening that at a moment when our city and state leaders have acknowledged our failure to promote equity in the vaccine rollout, that we're building this layer of segregation on top of it.
Kahn says there are long-term implications to vaccine passports. Once in use, he believes it will be hard to put that genie back in the bottle, even after vaccines are more widely accessible or after the pandemic is long over.
Even if this worked as advertised, it would still create a really chilling implication for privacy going forward. You know, this is creating what could turn into a permanent layer of surveillance infrastructure on the scale of nothing we've seen since 9/11. Assuming we're in the world where everyone has access to the vaccine, where everyone can suddenly get it if they want it, where we have that opportunity to reopen. The idea that you have a government app that can track every place you go, that can tell whether or not you're going to the supermarket or going to a church or going to a mosque or going to any number of other, you know, crowded spaces.
And he believes, as the nation also learned after 9/11, the stakes are higher for some than others.
As a white male U.S. citizen attorney, it's not much of a threat day to day to be tracked in this way. But for my clients, for someone who's undocumented, for someone who has criminal justice involvement, that can be a huge threat. And it can become this thing that chills participation in the most, you know, rudimentary parts of public life. It means maybe not going to that protest. It means maybe staying home from the mosque. It means second guessing what market you can go to. Do you just go to the local bodega? Or do you risk that you're going to be tracked going to the supermarket where you're forced to scan in?
That's Albert Fox Kahn, executive director of the New York-based Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. Again, we reached out to the state of New York for comment on the Excelsior Pass pilot program. It was used to regulate access to a Brooklyn Nets game at Barclays Center on February 27th and at a New York Rangers game on March 2nd at Madison Square Garden. The state did not respond to our requests. Okay, so Professor Farahani and Professor Faden, I just want to push this conversation I don't even want to use extreme, but I want to push this conversation well into the concern about civil liberties. I first, Professor Farahani, let me just start with you. To Albert Kahn's point about what we learned after 9/11, what would prevent a vaccine passport from turning into a tool where people might be relegated to some sort of secondary citizenship status based on their health status, based on their vaccination status. Do you have any confidence that we could prevent that from happening?
No, I have no confidence that we can prevent that from happening. So, you know, I have serious concerns about the equity of vaccine passports, not the least of which is because we do not have universal access to the vaccines right now. Even if we did have universal access to the vaccines, minority populations who have been hit the hardest within the United States don't have a tremendous amount of trust in our public institutions, and to condition their participation in society on taking the vaccines just further erodes that trust and further widens the gap. And then finally, these are not fully approved yet, right? So they are approved through emergency use authorization, but they haven't gone through their full regulatory approval process, and requiring people, conditioning their participation on society on taking a vaccine that has not gone through full regulatory approval, I find deeply problematic to build the kind of public trust and public science and our institutions of oversight that we need to be able to emerge from this pandemic and to be able to continue forward in adopting the practices that we need to truly be able to reopen society in an equitable fashion.
Yeah. And so to the both of you, please feel free to jump in on each other and talk through this together, because I want to hear as much as I can from both of you. But Professor Faden, let me just sort of piggyback off what Professor Farahani is saying. I will say that we have learned many lessons from 9/11, that once you hand over larger powers of surveillance to the United States federal government, to use the old cliche, you cannot stuff that genie back in the bottle. The state loves that expanded power, regardless of who's in the White House. And it makes perfect sense to me that public health would be an avenue through which that power is expanded. Initially, out of all the best intentions. I mean, the Patriot Act came to us because of concerns about terrorism. So initial intentions might be good, but these massive powers very quickly become perverted. And I just don't know how we could guarantee that a similar thing wouldn't happen with an app, a government app that would literally be tracking everywhere you go, the places you enter, you know, to Khan's point, whether you go to mosque, whether you go to church, et cetera. It does put a chill on civil liberties, doesn't it?
I'm sure it does, Meghna. But I will tell you that right now I'm more focused on the equity questions in the near term. So let's assume we had a magic technological solution or a magic low-tech solution to the concerns about this setting some sort of a precedent or transmuting itself into a permanent public health kind of Trojan horse to a more massive surveillance state. Let's just take the state of the pandemic right now. And I want to pick up on something that Nita said that I think is incredibly important. Right now, we're in a situation in which, depending on the state you're in, the rates of vaccination in white people is either somewhere between 2 to 4 times higher than among Latinx and African-American people. So that's staggeringly awful. There are two reasons why we are suspecting that we are seeing this gap. One is literally barriers to access, whether it's technology barriers to access to sign up or physical, literal geography barriers to access. It is harder to get a vaccine in low-income neighborhoods, in geographically isolated areas, and in communities that are dominantly communities of color. The other reason that's pointed to is a very justified distrust that these communities have in government generally, government institutions, and specifically in this case, public health institutions and medical care institutions. There are good reasons for this distrust. Mm-hmm. Right now, however, even in low-income communities, demand is exceeding supply. That is to say, there are many more African-American, Latinx people, low-income people, rural people who want the vaccine than can get it. Mm. And at very least, we shouldn't even be talking about vaccine passes until we get to the point where everyone in all communities who want the vaccine have an equal chance of being able to get it. So I'd say we're nowhere near the point at which it's even minimally ethically acceptable in the U.S. to offer a vaccine pass.
Okay, well, let me just jump in there. Just 1 second, and I want to hear from both of you. Then, given what you said, Professor Faden, point well taken, but the Biden administration is at least they haven't said anything officially yet, but they're asking the government agencies to look into the possibility. Do you think that that's premature?
No. Looking into the possibility is not premature, right? Looking into the possibility means inclusive of addressing the ethics concerns about when it will be appropriate, what should be the triggers to even to begin to consider. But absolutely, they should be thinking about this now. So I'm not upset at all, you know, Meghna, that the Biden administration is looking into this. I think it's good that they're looking into this. I think the caution should be we need to set up even the sort of minimal conditions under which it would be ethically acceptable to even consider this. And that's without going to the privacy and surveillance issues, which also are
But I actually think we need to go to the privacy and surveillance issues, too. So, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with Ruth about the issues that she's raised. But in setting up what the minimum conditions are that would be necessary before we implement it, it's also important to figure out when they would expire, when we would no longer use them, what the limitations would be. You know, a lot of problems with implementing new measures of surveillance is that we don't put in an end date. And so, you know, post 9/11, we stood up a lot of new provisions, some of which maybe the current and present threat don't justify. But once you implement something without thinking about here are the constraints, here's the limitations, here's the purpose for which it can be put, and here are the conditions under which, you know, if the pandemic is under control, if society no longer, you know, has the same level of risk and threat, if SARS-CoV-2 starts to look like the flu pandemic, not the pandemic, just the flu generally annually, maybe it doesn't make sense to have, you know, temperature checks at every place that you walk into, apps that you have to fill in your health information, nor a vaccine passport, which tells people whether or not you've had COVID or you've had the vaccine. And if we don't figure out both the minimum conditions necessary, such as universal access and availability of a vaccine, and also what the sunset provisions would be, I fear that both we will implement it too soon, too quickly, in ways that are deeply problematic for widening the equity gaps, but also have a kind of forever widening of surveillance, including to companies that we would never give that health information to, like IBM or Apple or Google, who are partnering with different organizations and don't necessarily have the privacy provisions in place or the firewalls between, you know, the information that they're gathering on our everyday digital lives and activities now triangulated with all of our COVID and health information.
Yeah. So I think you've brought up a really, really important part of this conversation. And Professor Faden, I'd love to hear from you in terms of like the bioethics of this. Because I think you could argue that health status at least is one of those sort of rare places in American life where you could at least guarantee some level of privacy now. I mean, HIPAA laws are there for a reason, and they function pretty decently. But, you know, the whole concept of these vaccine passports would be to, you know, grant people entry to facilities or buildings, et cetera, based on health status, essentially. Vaccination status is health status. I don't know if have we ever had anything like that in the United States?
Well, not at the absolute national level. We certainly have contexts in which people have to show evidence of vaccination, for example, for schools,
right,
K through 12 and pre-K, and in some cases other workplace contexts. But yes, this is at a scale that is unprecedented. I think we're in a place, and I completely wholeheartedly agree with Nita that we need to think through the sunset provisions. But if in fact we go in this direction, but I want to also take us back to why we would be doing this in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we would be doing this presumably to allow economic and social activity to move forward more quickly in a public health way that is safer in terms of containing the pandemic end goal. But there's another reason why it's being proposed, and that is to incentivize people to get vaccine. the idea here being, if you're not sure you want to get vaccinated and now you see that life will be better for you, well, maybe that's the reason to tip me over and get vaccine. And Nita's already hinted at this. I want to underscore it. It's really important. I think, Nita, you did more than hint. I think you stated it. There's two ways this could go. One way is it does function as a positive incentive. And the other, and people do who are on the fence then get motivated and get vaccinated. And that's, and this is the strategy that gets us to that sort of herd immunity tipping point, right? Which would be fabulously important. So let's acknowledge that. But it's also possible that it could boomerang, right? And instead of getting more people to agree to be vaccinated, it works the opposite direction, right? And because of concerns, because of fears, because of worries, whether you're undocumented, whether you have good justified reasons for distrusting government having information about you and so on, instead of this being a strategy that helps us get closer to the point at which we can open up the economy for everybody, it works the other way. So there are some very open empirical assumptions operating here.
Yeah, I think,
and that makes me nervous too.
And Professor Farahani, we just got a minute before the next break, but I think that there's ample sort of, if not empirical evidence, anecdotal evidence that people might see the, you know, in order to gain access again to normal life, you have to get a vaccine, even though the government is not requiring it. They would actually see that as a negative incentive, not a positive incentive. And I think the risk of turning people against it is very high in this country.
Absolutely. And I think it will just continue to sow more mistrust. And that's just, I think, really problematic. We want people to recognize that this is a good opportunity and to be able to make educated choices, not be forced into a choice by pressure and coercion.
Yeah. Or then possibly cut out of normal life again. That's and right. We don't know for how long either. We're going to talk about what this means at borders, at international borders, when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about or thinking through the implications of an idea of the vaccination passport. It's a program that has been launched in Israel. The EU is thinking about it. The UK is thinking about it. Here in the United States, the Biden administration has directed the government agencies to explore the possibilities. We haven't had any sort of national rollout of a vaccine passport here in the U.S. yet, but that's why it's the perfect time to talk about it. I'm joined today by Nita Farahani, professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. Ruth Faden also joins us. She is a professor of bioethics at Johns Hopkins University as well. And we're getting a lot of feedback online here. For example, Robin says, my small Vermont company does a lot of business in Africa and other emerging markets where the average age of the population is much lower, hence less risk, and access to vaccines more difficult. This could cripple diaspora income if OECD nations treat unvaccinated as more risky. Now, let's take a closer look at sort of the international implications of this idea. For example, in Greece, the prime minister there spoke with the BBC about Greece's push for all countries in the EU to adopt digitized vaccination certificate, which could be shown upon crossing borders. But he stressed that he would not call them passports.
We don't think that this is discriminatory at all. Restrictions already are in place and will accompany us throughout 2021. So it is not at all about discriminating visitors to those who have been vaccinated and those who haven't. Those who have not been vaccinated will still be able to travel. They will still be able to visit Greece if they want to, but they will do it in a slower process as they will have to undergo through testing or perhaps an isolation upon arrival.
In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said last month that even though vaccine passports are being vigorously discussed there, he didn't think they were needed or likely to be implemented.
What I don't think we will have in this country is, as it were, vaccination passports to allow you to go to, say, the pub or something like that. I think that that would be going it a bit. I think that if to just looking at the future, what we hope to have is such a high proportion of the population vaccinated that when you couple that with rapid testing, lateral flow testing, you really start to get the kind of answer that you're talking about.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson there talking about the use of a vaccine passport within the United Kingdom. But Ruth Faden, before we look at sort of what this issue might, how it might play out at borders, let me just ask you a question here, because we've got some listeners asking, if everyone has been vaccinated, why do we need a passport? And that seems to be what Prime Minister Johnson was talking about there, too. Your response to that?
Well, that's absolutely right. If we get enough people vaccinated, then this whole idea is useless within a country. It makes no sense. The data are building. The evidence base is growing to support the view that these vaccines do provide some significant protection against asymptomatic infection as well, and therefore onward transmission. So it's kind of a game, a tipping point, a modeling exercise to see at what point, how many people do we need to have vaccinated to be able to go forward and just open up as we would like to open up, and the idea of a vaccine pass goes away. But that's within countries, mm-hmm. right? So what you were hearing were two different kinds of concerns.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson is talking about what to do within England. The Prime Minister of Greece is deeply concerned about travel to Greece because it's a tourist economy in Greece. So there the concern is very different. It's about how does Greece increase the number of tourists it can get in this case, specific to the European Union, where the European Union, there's this focus on not requiring documents to move from one EU country to another that was stopped with respect to the pandemic. And now the issue for a country like Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, then basically so much of their income comes within Europe from tourism. That's the motivation there. And certainly this transcends to many other countries around the world. Take Thailand, for example. They're seriously interested in a global international passport because they're hurting for tourism in dollars as well.
So, Professor Farahani, I'm going to come back to you here in a second. But we also, in terms of this international aspect of the idea of a vaccination passport. We've got listeners, for example, someone calling themselves Doc says, when I first came to the U.S. in 1966, I carried my passport and vaccination booklet. Vaccination certificates were common for most travel in those decades. Now, Alexandra Phelan is a professor at Georgetown University Center for Global Health Science and Security. She specializes in infectious disease and international law. And we talked to her about this. She says that right now, international law only permits certain countries to require vaccines for yellow fever and polio.
The reason why it's so limited is because these sorts of measures, we've got about 150, 170 years of international law history where countries used to implement measures and a traveler would turn up and be told that they don't meet the standards or don't meet the measures and they'd be subjected to quite significant or invasive medical procedures or be sent back home. And so the idea around creating a really clear international legal arrangement is to give certainty and to not interrupt the flow of travelers and people around the world.
Just to be clear, right now we're talking about international law as it applies to travel, because vaccination requirements for immigration are frequently much more extensive. Now, Phelan says one potential problem with a COVID-19 vaccine passport, as a requirement for travel are the different kinds of vaccines available. For example, would countries allow travelers who'd received any COVID-19 vaccine?
And so if we're going to be adopting things like vaccine passports, are we only going to cover vaccines for which we have data? What about vaccines for yet we don't have data but have had significant uptake around the world?
For example, what would happen if the United States did not allow recipients of Russia's Sputnik vaccine to enter the country, or China's CoronaVac vaccine? In some trials, that vaccine is shown to be less effective than others.
The decision to include what vaccines or to accept a passport based on a vaccine may differ significantly between countries because of those practical questions, but also because of geopolitical matters, which we've seen over the last year and a bit have been particularly relevant.
And Phelan adds, as always, this undercurrent in this entire conversation, the possibility of disparate impact.
The real risk, if we introduce this sort of certification, is that the wealthy parts of the world get back to living a life as close to pre-pandemic as possible, whilst vaccine distribution continues to lag in other parts of the world, and people are then shut off from the global economy as a result.
That's Alexandra Phelan, professor at the Georgetown University Center for Global Health Science and Security. Nita Farahani, your thoughts on this?
This is such a complicated issue to think about it from an international perspective. And just one issue I want to put on the table that wasn't discussed there is, looking at the countries that don't have any vaccines available. Mm-hmm. So, there's the complication of those who have different vaccines that we don't have the data on. But many countries have very little availability, and they're far behind where we are in having access to vaccines for individuals within the countries. And so if you think about it from that perspective and then start to think, okay, we're going to shut down borders, we're going to prevent travel, we're going to have a world of have and have nots. We already have that world, and that world is just going to become worse and worse as we condition reopening, as we condition travel, as we condition access based on the possibility of getting access to a vaccine. But, it's also reasonable for us to recognize that right now there will be some limitations on the ability to travel between countries without some safeguarding of health of people within any particular country. And so, we've seen those kinds of lockdowns quite a bit during the pandemic. And I think recognizing that some of that may continue is a necessity. And the question is, how do you do that equitably? Do you decide, to prevent an entire country from being able to have the borders open to the United States or other countries? Do you figure out some other way to be able to do things like quarantine that enable quarantine and testing so that people can still travel even if they don't have access to vaccines? And I think you have to keep your eye to equity. You have to keep your eye to figuring out ways that if we're going to enable travel, it isn't conditioned purely on the ability to be fortunate enough to have access to a vaccine.
Yeah. In fact, on Monday, the WHO, in a press conference, said it's not recommending right now the need for a vaccine passport for travel. The WHO emergencies chief, Dr. Michael Ryan, said there are, quote, real, practical, and ethical considerations for countries considering using vaccine certification, and that the health agency is strongly advising against it for now. Okay, so that's where we are right now regarding the WHO.
Now, but I think that's right to say for now, right? I do think, first, it may not be relevant once it's available to everybody, or we may decide once there is universal access to safe and effective and fully approved vaccines that it is a necessary part for certain kinds of activities. I find that less potentially troubling than requiring it now when you have such problems with both, trust and availability and equity of access.
If I could jump in.
Please go ahead.
Would you rather not?
No, go ahead.
So one of the challenges, I completely agree with the WHO's statement. One of the challenges is that we're going to be looking at a massively disparate access to vaccines globally through probably at least 2023. So it's going to be years, right, before we see access to vaccine in many low and middle income countries approximate the level of vaccine access that we're going to have in the U.S. and in other wealthy and northern countries by the end of 2020, and by the end of the current year. So we're going to be living in a world for a long time, right, where we're going to have to figure out these travel policies with a backdrop of unequal access, profoundly unequal access to vaccine. At the same time, we're looking at a kind of paradox where the burden of disease and death in many low-income countries from this pandemic is way less. It's kind of very different from any other public health emergency we've experienced before.
The mortality rate in some countries is, what, one-tenth of what we've been seeing in the United States.
It's a fabulous public health mystery, and we have all kinds of hypotheses, and very wonderful pieces have been written recently to try to explicate what's going on here. But bottom line is, it remains a mystery. At the same time, these low and middle income countries are taking the greatest hit in many cases in terms of economic disparate impact. So just looking at what's happening to poverty rates and child welfare indicators, it's just pretty stunning. So it's a kind of multidimensional chess we're playing here from the standpoint of equity, access, the role of vaccine passports, and really what's in the best interests of low and middle income countries as well as high income countries. This is going to be very difficult to figure out. It's one thing to have a yellow fever, yellow card kind of a thing. And if I go to Nigeria, I have to show that I have been vaccinated with yellow fever, or I get a vaccine right in the airport. That's what has happened in the past in places like Nigeria. This is totally different. And let me just say one other thing that's causing heartburn at the WHO level. And that is the vaccine supply being so low, right? The prioritization roadmap that the WHO put forward placed travelers relatively low down in its prioritization roadmap. If, and this is something that was flagged by the WHO, if evidence of vaccination is going to be required for international travel, right, then countries may feel economically compelled to readjust their priority groups, which could be very significantly problematic from the public health point of view. Yeah. And finally, I'll say this and stop. We have the problem of the variants.
Right. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left in the conversation here, and I do want to just refocus it in the last moments that we have on, in the United States, issues of health, surveillance, civil liberties, and the long-term implications of concepts like vaccine passports. Amelia Burkhart sent us this tweet. She says, no good can come of a health passport. Way too much surveillance. Some people may choose not to get vaccinated. Does this mean doors are locked to society? Now, Professor Farahani, I don't think that we can say confidently that the United States government is going to make great decisions all the time. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking about how even in the world of health, we have seen, for example, regarding HIV, for years and years and years, even after we had a full understanding about how HIV is transmitted, even after there was, you know, terrific testing of blood supplies, even after we had really good treatments, no cure yet, but good treatments, it was only recently that the FDA changed its rules on blood donation, right? That previously a man who had slept with a man could not donate blood. Now it's like, then they gave them, they said, okay, well, if you've done that in the past year, you can't donate blood. Because of COVID, they changed it to, if you've done that in the past 3 months, then you can't donate blood. But my point is like, even after the science achieves certain things, policy always lags behind. And that's where we have long-term civil liberties implications. We just got a minute left here. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think we hastily put into place emergency measures that yield a lot of our civil liberties. You know, we're scared. We're all willing to accept, you know, in the moment, these different ways of infringing on our civil liberties, increasing surveillance, having all our everyday activities, our temperature monitor, giving health information easily and freely away to companies and to governments. And we don't think when we're doing that, that it's unbelievably important to make sure that we have sunset provisions that are going to end those things when the emergency ends. And once they're in place without those, it's too late.
Nita Farahany is a professor of law and philosophy at Duke and director of the Duke Initiative for Science and Society. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Ruth Faden, professor of bioethics and founder of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics as well. Professor Faden, thank you so very much for being with us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.